Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Scholarly Communications Channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I'm joined by Heather Ford, author of Writing the Revolution. Writing the Revolution was published by MIT Press in November 2022. In Writing the Revolution, Ford looks critically at how the Wikipedia article about the 2011 Egyptian Revolution evolved over the course of a decade, both shaping and being shaped by the revolution as it happened. When data are published in real time, they are subject to an intense battle over their meaning across multiple fronts. Ford answers key questions about how Wikipedia's so-called consensus is arrived at, who has the power to write dominant histories and which knowledges are actively rejected, how these battles play out across the chains of circulation in which data travels, and whether history is now written by algorithms. Associate Professor Heather Ford is Head of Discipline for Digital and Social Media in the School of Communications at the University of Technology, Sydney. She has a background working for global technology corporations and nonprofits in the US, UK, South Africa, and Kenya. A former Google Policy Fellow at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, former Executive Director of iCommons, and the co-founder of Creative Commons South Africa, her research focuses on the social implications of media technologies and the ways in which they might be better designed to prevent misinformation, social exclusion, and algorithmic bias. Heather, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you for having me, Jen.
Yeah, of course. And before we get started, I would love if you could introduce yourself a little, maybe speak about where you grew up and went to school and perhaps what got you into the open knowledge movement.
Awesome. So I am South African. I lived in South Africa most of my life. I was born in a small town called Pietermaritzburg, near Durban, which is on the kind of east coast of South Africa. I went to university at Rhodes University, studied journalism there, and started life in my first job working for a democracy nonprofit called the Electoral Institute of Southern Africa. This was 1999, 2000, so a really good time in South Africa for working on democracy support. And that's when I started getting involved in the nonprofit technology space, I guess, mostly in Africa. And that's when the first internet laws, as they were called, were being promulgated. And I was really interested in the power of this new technology for socioeconomic development and education. And I've had a strange kind of education since then. I went to Stanford to do a fellowship it was called the Social Entrepreneurship Fellowship. And then I actually only went and did my master's at UC Berkeley in Information Management and Systems at the former library school. And then I did my PhD at Oxford University at the Oxford Internet Institute. And that's when I really started delving more into Wikipedia and the case study that we're going to talk about today.
That's really a global path through education and all kinds of things. So turning to your book, Writing the Revolution, can you maybe speak more about your work with Creative Commons and Wikipedia, and then the goals that you brought from all of that work to writing this book?
Yeah, so I am one of the co-founders of Creative Commons South Africa, and that happened on the back of my fellowship at Stanford. I was really excited about Creative Commons when I first heard Lawrence Lessig speak about it at Oxford when I first moved to the UK, I think in about 2002. Creative Commons was only a few months old then, and I was really excited about Creative Commons because I felt like it was really offering the Global South and Africa, where I was from and had been doing a lot of nonprofit work, this really great opportunity to share knowledge about our places and local content. And Wikipedia really was the instantiation of the license because it was the greatest example of how the license could be used to share knowledge about the world in one's own language. So in my work with iCommons when I was executive director, I hosted Jimmy Wales and other folks from the free and open source software movement on numerous occasions. And we did, you know, I think probably the first editathon in Johannesburg, and students at a university, inner city university, were editing Wikipedia in their own language. And I was really excited about it, but my skepticism really grew during this period, up until about 2009, when I went back to university because I didn't really know what else to do. And my skepticism was that all the licenses in the world wouldn't change the fact that there were reasons other than whether knowledge was true or not, or whether you had a license that enabled you to share it or not, in actually sharing that knowledge and people listening and hearing that. So, you know, it's not just true facts or true statements or the ability to share that affects whether we know stuff about the world. I was starting to see a lot of bias and racism in the ways in which knowledge was accepted or not in places even like Wikipedia. And so this book was really an exploration, a very broad exploration and an open exploration of how Wikipedia shapes the world in ways that we don't usually think about it. Because when we think about Wikipedia shaping, we usually think about, you know, vandalism or disinformation. And those are really obvious cases of people trying to shape Wikipedia for worse. But actually, like any knowledge project, Wikipedia is shaped and influenced by the people and the technologies that create it. And so that's the book is really taking this really positive example in many ways, and trying to look at all the ways in which knowledge was shaped for reasons other than whether things were true or not.
Yeah. Thank you. That's like an exciting framework for thinking about Wikipedia. So then in chapter one, you share some anecdotes about how Wikipedia's content circulates on the internet. And you argue that what we're seeing is an epistemological revolution of knowledge platforms becoming a direct source of facts rather than a directory of other knowledge sources. And can you explain more about that shift and why it matters?
Great. Yeah. I mean, this is what's happened in the last 10 years, and something I saw shortly after the revolution in 2011. So, it started with Google, but all the other major search engines and platforms have followed. When you used to search for, say, the Egyptian Revolution or Heather Ford on Google, Google would give you a long list, still does, give you a long list of sources in which you might find more information about the Egyptian Revolution or Heather Ford. And it used to prioritize, it prioritizes sources, and Wikipedia was always up there in the sources that it prioritized. But it really was a directory. It's a directory, but it helped you find the information really quickly by going to one of the top search results. But in 2012, something really radical happened. And that was that Google presented a little fact box on the right-hand side of the page when you searched for the Egyptian Revolution or Heather Ford. And the fact box wasn't just displaying a list of possible sources that could possibly answer your question. It actually was presenting single facts about what you were searching for, so single answers to your questions. And these were presented in a way that looks really authoritative. And a lot of these claims or statements are actually being sourced directly from Wikipedia. We don't know that all the time, because a lot of the time the citations are actually removed. But this technology is also being used to develop conversation agents in chatbots and in smart speakers. So you can ask questions of your smart speaker and it will give you answers. There's no ifs or buts there. There's no list of possible answers. It is a direct answer to your question. And that, I think, is a really, really important move that not a lot of people have actually paid much attention to, but I think is really significant, because it, you know, we talk about the power of these platforms, but this really, really consolidates platforms like Google, and, you know, enables it to become much more of a monopoly in terms of being seen as the authoritative source of knowledge about the world.
Absolutely. That knowledge box really changed things. And for myself as a Wikipedia editor, changed how I think about the possibility of what can happen when I edit Wikipedia and potentially influence what's then showing up in Google, which leads a little into my next question. Something else you talk about in chapter one is mirror theory, and I really appreciated how clearly you explained this. Mirror theory posits that Wikipedia's biases originate from outside Wikipedia, and you challenge mirror theory and its assumptions about Wikipedia's neutrality. So for listeners who aren't familiar with mirror theory, could you share a little more about it and explain why you think it isn't true?
Great. Yeah, so the way that Wikipedia's biases are explained are usually according to this thing called, that I've called the mirror theory. And the best way to explain it is by example. So in 2018, Donna Strickland won the Nobel Prize in Physics. And journalists at the time, when she won the prize, were writing stories about the fact that Wikipedia didn't even have an article about Donna Strickland before she won the prize, and that some editors had tried to start an article about Donna Strickland, and they had had those articles deleted because Strickland supposedly wasn't notable enough to be on the encyclopedia. And so, you know, the story was that Wikipedia once again is biased against women, and it's not allowing it, you know, Donna Strickland had to win the Nobel Prize in order to actually be recognized by Wikipedia. Catherine Meyer, who was the executive director of Wikimedia Foundation at the time, responded to journalists and said, you know, journalists, don't come after us. It's actually you who are also to blame, because Wikipedia is just a mirror of the world's biases, not a source of them. And this was really interesting because this really clearly encapsulates the feeling of Wikipedians often that all they're doing is summarizing what reliable sources say about the world. They're not actually producing truths on their own. And of course, Catherine received a lot of pushback on this, and in true Catherine fashion, because she's a wonderful, reflexive person, did come back and say, you know, she made an error, and it's true that Wikipedia is not perfect, and it does actually have a lot of problems with systemic bias. Problem is that no one's really been able to articulate really well, other than, you know, a few people, what this bias is, because Wikipedians certainly do summarize sources, and they are not allowed to represent what they call original points of view or original perspectives or do original research. And so, you know, again, this book is trying to figure out, in the context of this single article, what are some of the ways in which Wikipedia actually does that or enables this to happen?
Yeah. Right, because you're arguing in the book that Wikipedia is knowledge infrastructure and not just an encyclopedia, and it's becoming authoritative because of the way it's viewed as consensus truth. And so the core example in your book is one Wikipedia article related to the revolution in Egypt in 2011. And you orient readers to that in chapter 2. So could you give listeners a little context on the origins of how the origins of the revolution were framed in the media broadly, and then how one Wikipedia user also started doing the work of documenting all of that?
Thanks, Jen. Yeah, I mean, it's really important to look at this stuff historically, because, you know, when we look in 2022 at the Egyptian revolution, it just seems so obvious. You know, obviously a revolution was about to happen in Egypt. But actually, at the time, so that's January 2011, the Tunisian revolution had just happened, and no one really, at least from the Western world or the global north, was actually suspecting that Egypt would follow Tunisia's path. The broad consensus in the media at the time, including an article on the BBC, was that Egypt wouldn't revolt. It would not see the same revolution that Tunisia had seen. And so this was actually a big surprise when it happened. And that's one of the reasons why the Western media wasn't actually in Egypt during the first days of the protest. But yeah, in January, a single Wikipedia editor called the Egyptian Liberal created the article. He actually created the article the day before the protest began, which is super interesting. They'd been planned by democracy activists like him, young Egyptian, had been involved in democracy activism for many years, and this seemed like a great opportunity, but no one actually knew whether people would show up. They'd had protests planned for Police Day on the 25th, but no one knew whether people would show up. And so he prepared the article using a single source from the AFP, which was actually about the planned protest. It wasn't about, because it was the day before, there was no journalistic articles about the protest, and no one was expecting it. So he prepared the article and he published it within a couple of hours of the protest actually beginning on the 25th of January.
Yeah, and that example really shifts our understanding of Wikipedia documenting very much after the fact. That proactiveness is really, really fascinating. And so one of the key points that you make about the work that the Egyptian Liberal is doing is that they're not only responding to framing by the media when they write the article, but they're also doing the work of framing for Wikipedia readers, and also perhaps more importantly for Wikipedia editors who will be working with them on this. So I would love if you could speak more about why it's so important to note the framing work that's being done in this moment by Wikipedia and its users.
Great. So probably two things that are really important in understanding how Wikipedians frame and make decisions about what they're representing. The first is that Wikipedians decide whether a topic, a subject, a claim is worthy of documentation or not. Now, this is when Wikipedians decide whether an article like the one that the Egyptian liberal published on January 25, 2011, should continue to exist, because many articles that are created every day are put up for deletion or immediately deleted because a single Wikipedian or a group of Wikipedians decide that it's not either notable enough or more generally doesn't comply with the regulations that are described in Wikipedia policy, one of which is about notability, and you know there's other rules about whether an event should be documented or not. So the first is they decide whether an event is worthy of documentation or not, because it could have just as easily happened that the Egyptian liberal didn't get enough support for the article and it could have been deleted, right? The second is deciding how an event is categorized or how a subject is categorized. So in the case of the Egyptian Revolution, these classifications really, really matter. They're very political and they influence how events are received and how they are responded to, particularly in an international context where the US, for example, and its support or opposition to the revolution would have been really critical to the revolution's success. So deciding how it's categorized as either a protest or a revolution, for example, or whether it's a localized protest or widespread nationally, or kind of the reasons why the protest has happened, all of these categories that are very fiercely debated by Wikipedians are really important, especially in the first stages of the event, to the evolution of the event, to what happens during the event. So it's really important in terms of framing the event, what kind of subject it is, whether it's important or not, how important it is. And that kind of framing is really critical, not only to the way that we perceive the events that are happening on the ground, but also the response to them, which is kind of amazing when you think about it. It's really, really powerful. And I should also say that every representation of an event is powerful in the same way, right? This is what media does. It frames our response to it by kind of shaping meaning. But what's really interesting about Wikipedia and why it's so important is how critical it's become in terms of, bigger infrastructures of fact travel and how powerful it is. But I think you probably want to get to that a bit later. So we'll leave it for there.
Sure. Yeah.
Too enthusiastically.
Definitely. And I mean, I think that framing work is something we have been taught that Wikipedia doesn't do, that it is this neutral, reflective mirror, and watching for it as a mechanism that is doing the work of framing is really valuable, as you point out. Another thing that you talked about then in chapter four is that as this evolved, you learned some things about sources. So you talked about some of your prior work analyzing sources used in Wikipedia articles. And you noted that your thinking about sources changed radically when you started analyzing this Egyptian protest article. Can you explain more about how your thinking changed and how your observations challenged the belief of the Egyptian government that it controlled local media at the time?
Great, yeah. So sources on Wikipedia are really critical because of the fact that Wikipedians are only allowed to summarize what they call reliable sources are saying about a particular topic. So sources are really critical. If you're trying to figure out how a topic is framed, going to look at sources is a really great way of kind of analyzing it. And I'd been looking at sources for many years before I started looking at this article, actually. And I'd done some really interesting work with some great data scientists in the US, including Shilad Sen and David Musikant. And we'd done some work on sources, and basically the big picture when you analyze millions of sources across multiple language versions of Wikipedia is that the general rule is that Wikipedia, on English Wikipedia, you'll see English sources from the majority of which are from the US, originate in the US, some from the UK, but and if you're looking at Arabic Wikipedia, you'll see majority Arabic language sources. And so what was really interesting in this case is that what I saw when I started looking at the article is that Al Jazeera, which Saudi Arabian owned media company, was actually really the most powerful source by far in this article. And things like the New York Times and the BBC actually trailed long behind them in the English language Wikipedia. And we also saw some Arabic language sources. And so what you actually see in the documentation of historical events is that Wikipedians need sources. And so they use not what is best according to policy, which is according to the policy is, you know, academic peer-reviewed sources, but also just what's available. And when you're documenting a current event like this, Al Jazeera really was the only source that was covering the protests in English and in Arabic, because, as I said before, none of the other major international news outlets, English language ones especially, were covering. They weren't even in Egypt at the time. And so Al Jazeera really rose to the forefront of this coverage and actually influenced, I think, to a large extent, not only Wikipedia's coverage, but global coverage of the event, because they were there, and they this was also the rise to prominence of Al Jazeera, because during the Iraq war the US had seen Al Jazeera as kind of government propaganda, but for the first time during the Egyptian revolution they became recognized kind of officially even by the US government as a source of reliable news. And so really the media that is able to take advantage of these situations by luck, really by chance, I think in Al Jazeera's case, but also some really good coverage, were really able to frame events in really interesting ways.
Thanks. And there's another type of source, maybe, although perhaps it's not a source and just an influence, that you talk about in chapter four. That I was fascinated by. You explained that even though Wikipedia forbids original research, the local knowledge provided by Wikipedians is critical to the success of this article. You highlight a few key loopholes that let protesters impact the article's development through Wikimedia Commons. Can you speak more about how Wikipedia is actually a space for local knowledge to impact the way information is created on the platform?
Yeah, so this was really fascinating too. I mean, I guess this is how knowledge gets produced in practice versus on paper in every case, but it was super interesting to witness it in watching this article develop over time. And as you said, Wikipedians are not allowed to do original research. They can't bring themselves to the article in any way. But there was a number of cases in which Wikipedians clearly were actively bringing their own knowledge to the ways in which the article developed. And in fact, you know, this is probably, as I say, you know, the way that knowledge is developed more generally. So one case was where the Egyptian liberal who started the article, there was a lot of lack of clarity when events were happening so fast and you had so many different sources saying different things. And in one case, Wael Gabara, who was the former Google employee who was jailed by the regime because he started the Facebook page that was one of the sources of the revolution. No one knew whether he was still the manager or the organizer of the page, the Facebook page. And so in order for the Wikipedians to reflect this accurately, they had to, well, they said, does anyone know? And the Egyptian liberal, because he was one of the only Egyptians actually involved in the article, the English language article, and he said, yes, he's just spoken to Wael, and Wael is still the owner of the page. And so, you know, there's a lot of these cases where Wikipedians are actually bringing their own knowledge to it. In the case of Wikimedia Commons, I think if I remember correctly, and I was going to check this, but I didn't get around to it, but so Wikimedia Commons is where photographs are housed that are used for Wikipedia. Photographs and video was housed. And so I think the case that you're referring to was when editors captioned the images. There was one image in particular that was subject to a lot of debate about what was actually happening in the photo, because some said it was plainclothes policemen beating up someone, beating up these protesters, but others said they were just other protesters fighting among themselves. And so here was a case where editors really had to kind of reflect what they thought was happening, but no one actually knew because it was a still photo, and they really could represent what was happening in this photo according to their perspective. Was that the example that you were thinking of?
Yeah, well, and I think you also mentioned that if there is no source about something, anybody can upload an image to Wikimedia Commons, and that it is a type of source that can be integrated into an article. And I never thought about it that directly, but of course that makes sense. And we do that all the time with different events to, you know, gather more photos about specific places or topics to have better representation on Wikimedia Commons, but I'd never thought about how that can be quite so strategic.
Yes,
as in this example.
No, it's true, because you know, when you think of the image, so there was a lot of debate also about the image in the info box that should represent the revolution, and you can, when you start to think about the choices available, you can really imagine how much meaning an image actually brings, and how it also helps to frame the ways in which the article or the subject is being interpreted. You know, the current image and the image that's been used for many years is the image of Tahrir Square with, you know, thousands and thousands of thousands of people, you know, in a circular formation just when Mubarak's resignation was announced. And, you know, there were other options there of a single protester on the lion statue that's often used. And, yeah, I mean, I think images are a potential framing device that are probably more powerful than, you know, single claims or statements. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And then another framing device is the title of the article. Mm-hmm. And so in the fifth chapter, you go into a lot of detail about the eventual name change of this article, shifting it to Egyptian Revolution. And you point out that the process for this involved some actions that show us a tension between two goals of Wikipedia, the goal of retaining a neutral point of view and reflecting current information. Can you speak a little more about that tension and about the symbolic action of renaming this Wikipedia page?
Yeah, so this is a common tension, and it's actually in the book I talk about how it's actually Wikipedia has evolved over time to being much more receptive to the documentation of current events than it has been in the past. But Wikipedia also recognizes that it's an encyclopedia and that it shouldn't be too quick in its documentation or reflection of what's happening, because in the end, they really value their neutrality as they see it, and that's really critical to their authority. But that's actually really, really difficult, as you can imagine, in the case of evolving events like this, because you don't want to wait for a historian, you know, 2, 3, 4 years at best to write the history of the Egyptian Revolution in order to update the article. And so there is, as you say, this tension between being current and being really sure that they're reflecting what reliable sources in some are saying about a topic. And this was really, this is always really demonstrable in the renaming of articles. So when some historic event happens, the Queen of England, the Queen, you know, dying, or in this case, a protest becoming a revolution, which is very subjective. It's very hard to actually recognize. So what does it take to make a revolution? It's an interpretive act. And so the renaming of this article from protest to revolution was really an important step. And editors had been trying, some very activist editors had been trying to change this article to revolution since the beginning of the protests. And other editors were saying, no, it's too soon. You know, reliable sources are not calling it a revolution, so don't even start, you know. But everyone was expecting that Mubarak would resign. And so the idea was that when the government fell, and by government they were interpreting it as the resignation by Hosni Mubarak, who had been the source of so much hatred by the protesters, when he resigned, there was this sudden move by a mass of editors, many of whom had not been involved in the article prior to this, all moving into the page and trying to change the name of the article from 2011 Egyptian protests to 2011 revolution. Now, some of the editors who had been there for a while were saying, no, you have to wait. We have to wait. Other editors started a poll on the talk page and said, can editors weigh in on whether the name should be changed now that Mubarak has resigned? This is all happening within minutes and then hours of his resignation. Some editors are still asleep, right? I mean, many of them were editing around the clock, but this is day 10 and the US, I think the US, they were still asleep. And at least on the West Coast. And so editors tried to stop this massive crowd that moved into the article, but eventually they just gave up because the sentiment was so powerful. And they did see that some notable outlets like the BBC and New York Times were calling it revolution. So they basically just let the crowd take over. There was no kind of official decision. In fact, the poll that they started, the article was actually changed before the poll had had a decision made about it, which was fascinating to see when I did the calculations. So, you know, a lot of editors who were weighing in on this decision were doing so, you know, meaninglessly because the article had its name changed long before. And so, yeah, there was a lot of other kinds of action that happened around to support the name change. One very interesting fact is that the Tunisian protest had not actually been deemed a revolution by Wikipedia, even though their leader, president, had fled the country, resigned. But that article was still called the Tunisian Protests. And so what the Egyptian liberal had been trying to do, and another editor succeeded in doing, was to change the name of that article to Tunisian Protests, because if that article hadn't been named as a revolution, sorry, to change it to Tunisian Revolution, if that article hadn't been named Tunisian Revolution, then the logic by which the Egyptian revolution was being changed, i.e. when a leader exits from office, that wouldn't have been very well supported. So they needed to change that article. And so what's so interesting there is that you can actually see this kind of wave or spring happening materially in the renaming of these articles, and how one article and one event influenced by the strange action, the other article and the other event, and then all the other revolutions that occurred subsequently.
Yeah, that is really interesting to think about the order of things in the quote-unquote real world versus the order of things on Wikipedia. And so we've been talking a lot about what happened on Wikipedia, and I want to shift to talking about what happened outside of Wikipedia. Because in chapter 6, you follow the journey that this article takes outside the platform. So as information in the article connects to Wikidata and to Google's knowledge graphs, which we talked a little bit about at the beginning, how is all of this influencing what we understand as fact and as authority, and what are some of the risks in all of that?
Yeah, so as I was saying, in 2012, Google makes this big change that's actually supported by this new project called Wikidata, which is started by the Wikimedia Foundation, particularly the German kind of chapter. And Wikidata's goal is really to extract, or it wasn't actually originally to extract facts, but to represent originally just interwiki links, which are connections between different language versions of the same Wikipedia article. And so Wikidata starts becoming this home for facts that are housed in Wikipedia, Wikimedia Commons, and other Wikimedia projects. And this really supports Google's Knowledge Graph project, which also is systematizing facts and extracting them from the web. But Wikipedia becomes really important to that. And in particular, Wikipedia's info boxes become really important. And those are the little fact boxes on the right-hand side of the Wikipedia articles. And so what you find here is that Wikipedia is always really popular. It's a popular source. Now I think it's 11th most popular, or 7th now, I can't remember. But it is one of the most popular websites in the world. People look to Wikipedia to find out things about the world or to check facts. But now it becomes even more important because Google is actually a lot more powerful than Wikipedia is. And so what happens just in terms of its popularity and its authoritativeness. And so what happens when Google extracts facts from Wikipedia rather than just showing a Wikipedia article in its entirety as a potential source of an answer to your question, what happens then is the authority of those facts in the info box grows substantially, and it grows because claims become really simplified and decontextualized. So, for example, when you see the claim that in the Google's knowledge box that a certain number of people died, and that there's no source or citation for that claim, for example, it really looks a lot more authoritative than if you give it a lot of caveats and you contextualize the information, right? And again, this is not new. We've known this for a long time that when facts don't have this contextual information, they appear more authoritative. And so what happens problematically when Google starts extracting its facts using machine learning to populate this massive database of facts in Google's knowledge graph is that we have a decoupling of the fact from its source and from the social context that we talked about before. So all the reasons, or all the things that are actually really useful to know about when you're evaluating whether a statement is true or not, or whether you should trust it enough for the thing that you're needing it for, I guess. When the sources and citations are removed, and when the link to the Wikipedia article is removed, and when the virtual assistant or the smart speaker gives you the answer without citing the source, then it looks more authoritative than it is. And also, you can't question the source, you can't, or the fact, you can't discuss it in the same way that you can do on Wikipedia. So this disconnection happens increasingly from 2012, and the risks of the journey, as I've said, from Wikipedia to these other places, notably the database or the knowledge graph, is that this contextual information that's actually really critical to evaluating it disappears.
Definitely. The decontextualization really changes things, as you say. So then in your final chapter, you reflect on how history is now written by those who can create and share data. And you note that the real power dynamics lie in this knowledge creation process. This process, as it happens on and outward from Wikipedia, brings us back to your initial argument that we're seeing an epistemological revolution in the way Wikipedia functions in the world as an encyclopedia. Could you speak about some of the suggestions you make for how we can improve the platforms that house and curate our knowledge about the world? What do we need to shift both about how we understand those platforms and also how we interact with them.
Yeah, so I've gone around this question of bias for many, many years. And I think what I've really realized is that all these debiasing, so-called debiasing activities that we engage in are not evil or bad in their own, but they're problematic because we cannot ever fully debias any representation, whether it's from Wikipedia or the most notable scientist. We cannot remove the frame. And so I'm really inspired by thinkers like Donna Haraway and other feminist sociologists of science and technology who really emphasize the fact that what we should be doing is really trying to situate knowledge. So as much as possible, to contextualize where knowledge is coming from and to then make the frames visible. So knowing that, because there is no representation outside the frame. And so my work now is really just about this. It's not about trying to debias by adding more voices. And I'm not saying that that's not important work to do. It is very important work to do, but it can't be the only goal. The goal also should be about trying to make the context of knowledge available. In addition to all the very, very, very critical work around competition, because the monopoly status of all these platforms, including Wikipedia, actually, are very problematic. But, you know, the frame is really important. And I think what we should be doing is trying to think about practical ways in which we can contextualize the knowledge that is represented in these platforms.
That includes context.
I should explain what I mean. So that includes things like, when was the claim made? It's kind of temporality. When was the claim made? That's really important to know, right? A claim that was made 100 years ago versus a claim that was made 5 seconds ago. Who made the claim? So the source of the claim and its sources is really important. And information about where the claim was made, for example, become really critical. So the kind of geographical locus of a claim and the extent to which, in the context of an event, that becomes really important. To what extent is the claim made in the locus or the location in which the event is happening is very different to a claim that's made very far from the event. And so these kinds of contextual clues or contextual data is actually really, really critical to us being able to evaluate the claims that are being made on platforms like this. And so I think we should be paying a lot more attention to these kinds of data rather than only whether by some global standard a claim is true or not.
Definitely. We need like a more nuanced set of literacy tools for sure. And figuring out what those are. It's a big project.
Yeah.
I don't want to take too much more of your time, but before we wrap up, I would love to hear what you're working on next, what research projects you have on your plate now, if you're working on any of the issues that you raised in your book.
Great. Yeah, so as you said, this is a big project, but it is my project. And actually, there are some very practical things that we can be doing. And so my latest project is on question answering machines. And question answering machines are is a new facility that we're being enabled by, represented by things like virtual assistants and smart speakers that enable you to ask and have a question answered about the world. And so I think this is really interesting feature of kind of the everyday application of AI and machine learning. And I think what I've been doing in my latest projects that you can find at questionmachines.net is trying to explore how everyday questions about the world can be answered in ways that contextualize those answers. So platforms, as I said, are extracting these answers from all over the web, but they're often decontextualizing them by not offering all the things that I was talking about before. And so these things are very practical to do. So if we had to have a question answering machine that did give us context, that did enable us to evaluate the answers that it's providing, what would that look like? And so I'm really at the beginning stages of that project to explore with other, with data scientists and digital literacy experts, what this would look like in the practical instance of a smart speaker that only has a voice. How might smart speakers present answers in what I think is a more ethical way, which is, you know, providing this situated knowledge.
That's exciting. I like to think about more ethical smart speakers, more contextual responses from our smart speakers. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today. Once again, my guest is Heather Ford, author of Writing the Revolution, published by MIT Press. My name is Jen Hoyer, and you have been listening to the Scholarly Communications channel of New Books Network.